Welcome to Physics Frontiers, Episode 37, The Einstein-Cartan Torsion Field Theory. Show notes, including the papers we read for this podcast, can be found at frontiers.physicsfm.com/37.
Hey, Randy, what's going on?
So this week, we are going to jump into a really, I think, fascinating extension. I think that's the proper way to model it. Extension of general relativity, called the Einstein-Cartan Torsion Field Theory.
The theory shows up fairly early. The original Cartan theory, Eli Cartan did this in, what, 1922, 1923?
That's right, right around there, yeah. So shortly after general relativity came out.
Yeah, he had a series of papers about this. Can you tell me sort of the basics about it? What is the Einstein-Cartan theory?
Well, I don't know how I could sum it up in a nutshell, but I guess what we're talking about here is the fact that all of the fundamental particles have spin. And if you look at how that spin can couple to the gravitational field, then you can find kind of a new term that you can append on to the existing Einstein field equation, which accounts for the internal, for an internal property. These fields, this torsion field, doesn't radiate beyond the surface of a body. It's what happens inside matter as a result of these spin particles. And even if they're spinning in random directions, that spin field doesn't sum to zero. So if you couple that to general relativity, you end up predicting a whole spectrum of fascinating new properties, and yet you can still preserve all of the short-range effects that we know and love through observation and experiment. So it's a true extension, I think, of general relativity from what I'm seeing here and from what they've presented in these papers and showed you how it works together.
Okay, yeah, this torsion model, Eli Cartan did this prior to the discovery of spin. So there was no spin when he first did it. He just assumed that there was some sort of torsion field available and showed what would happen in that case. So even though later on people have decided they wanted to use it to try to incorporate the spin into general relativity, see what happens with that sort of conservation of angular momentum stuff in the material. Originally, it was not based on this quantum mechanical property that called spin, this angular momentum that every object in the universe basically has. That's what it is. You basically add on this torsion field that exists in matter and disappears outside of matter.
Maybe we should read off the titles of these papers that we're going to talk about. The Accelerating Universe with Space-Time Torsion but Without Dark Matter and Dark Energy by A.V. Menkevich. That was a Physics Letters B paper from 2009. And I always like to do these chronologically so we can sort of gauge the more recent advancements at the end of the show. The next paper is Non-Singular Dirac Particles in Space-Time with Torsion by Poplawski, and that's Physics Letters B, 2010. And this last one is Space-Time Torsion as a Possible Remedy to Major Problems in Gravity and Cosmology by Poplawski. And that was in Astronomical Review in 2013, but he wrote it in 2011. And that's where it gets into some of the really broad, incredibly kind of exciting concepts in torsion field theory and some of the predictions that it's making and some of the solutions that it offers to the major outstanding problems in cosmology.
Yeah, that's right, Randy. Leave the best stuff to the end.
That's right.
Keep them waiting.
Oh, and I should also do a little shout out to Linda because she's been so great putting nice comments on our podcast page.
Thanks, Linda.
Thank you, Linda. It's always great to hear from her. Okay, so what got me started on this actually recently was, if you actually dig deeper into it, you find that there's an ultraviolet divergence solution because a cutoff is introduced when they realized that these singular solutions and even string-like singularities like we see in the Kerr metric and for spinning black holes, those are non-physical under Einstein-Cartan theory. It offers a solution which kind of forces these matter states to reach a finite density, which I think is absolutely exciting that there's like a fundamental physics solution to eliminating singularities in physics, which are a huge problem. So the first papers are very sophisticated, and it goes into this solutions for the dark energy and dark matter observations using torsion field theory.
Now, this is the one that actually had two spin fields, two torsion fields. So that was a little bit different right there. Why did it need two torsion fields? Do you remember that?
I'm trying to remember why that was. I don't recall that offhand.
Okay, so I definitely don't. This was the one that I didn't read a second time. It was also the first one I read, so I wasn't really sure about that. But I think it probably has the two fields so that it can take care of both the dark energy and the dark matter, which is its goal, right? It wants to explain dark energy and dark matter with the torsion field.
But for some reason, I thought that fell out naturally through this approach where they went into the Poincaré gauge theory of gravity.
Yeah, I think that's what's happening, but I think you needed less, then you'd probably use less, right?
Yeah, but I got the impression, maybe it's the wrong impression, that the local gauge invariance principle led them to a two-torsion model. One of the things that I found fascinating with this is that it says that in the case of usual gravitating matter with positive values of energy density and pressure, the gravitational interaction can be repulsive in this model. That's riveting, because we often see with debates about general relativity and things like the cosmological constant that gravitation is always considered to be positive, and it just simply can't ever be repulsive without having a negative energy state. And yet, in this theory, you certainly can. So that makes it really appealing as a dark energy solution.
That is interesting. That gives you the dark energy. But does it give you the same sort of parameters that the other ones do for the effective energy?
I wasn't able to copy the equations down onto my Word document, so I don't have the equations in front of me.
I do not see an explicit equation in here for the effective energy. So in the other papers, there is an explicit equation for the effective energy. I don't see it here. It has other parameters that go into Friedman-like equations, and those parameters can have negative values, but it doesn't explicitly have an effective energy. So you end up with those negative values, then you have something like dark energy in the Friedman equations for the Hubble constant.
Yeah, this first paper is a letter more than like a full paper, so it's a little sparse on the details.
A couple of them are. I mean, there's nothing bad about them. It's just that there are a lot of parameters sitting around that aren't really well defined. It's got a lot of, I can write this Lagrangian, and it's got all of these different terms, and there's some constants in front of them, but you don't really know what those constants are. However, if I play around with them, I can get this or that or the other thing that I want. So that's a little disappointing.
Yeah, but it seems like a lot of this is based on just that one-dimensionless parameter, E, if M, he sort of fine-tunes that to match the observations. Then he ended up with a model that seems to work in terms of predicting the correct values for the dark energy and the dark matter effects that we're seeing. That's intriguing. This torsion field theory seems to be more significant in these really intense gravitating regimes like the cosmic inflation era and in black holes. And in most of the other regimes, the densities are too low for the spin, I guess the spin density, to really play a major factor. And so it reduces to GR. And that's encouraging, too. It seems like a theoretically natural outcome that you find only in these really extreme regimes. Does it become observable that there's a difference between the two? And that's sort of what you'd hope for in an expansion of general relativity.
That's more or less what we need. I mean, we talked about the post-Newtonian framework a few episodes ago, and that really just tells you that there isn't a lot of wiggle room. So that it has to be the same outside of the body is important. At least it has to have the same sort of properties with a modified energy, basically. It is really interesting for this particular case that he ended up with the density to give the correct sort of dark energy-like solution was similar to the density of baryonic matter that we measure.
Right. He was within a factor of 8, I think. So they're within an order of magnitude, which is pretty good for government work, huh?
That's pretty reasonable, especially when you have a bunch of parameters sitting around to play with. You know, you might be able to improve that a little bit. Anyways, I mean, that looks good. What's ever going on with this spin field is allowing that sort of stuff to happen.
And he notes here that, unlike in GR, in the framework of the Poincaré group gauge theory, that the law of gravitational attraction doesn't conform to Newton's law at the cosmological scale. So that's pretty exciting. This finding seems to be saying, therefore, that I guess gravitational field would drop to zero at a finite scale, and beyond that, there would be a repulsion.
Well, that's interesting. So he's saying that it doesn't actually collapse down to Newton's laws.
He's getting like a Mond-like result from a fundamental theory instead of kind of doing the patchwork that we saw with Mond.
All right. Well, that's interesting. That may be the reason why he's saying that it is not a metric theory. That was sort of the big question that I had here was when he started talking about this not being a metric theory. Because to me, it seems like it has all the necessary parts of a metric theory of gravity. So a metric theory of gravity, what does that need? That needs gravitation to be mediated through a symmetric metric tensor. The metric tensor stays symmetric. The torsion field is an anti-symmetric tensor, but that's not what's actually pushing and pulling things still, right? It's still just the metric giving you the geodesics. On top of that, the physics should be Lorentz invariant and position invariant. And if you have all of those things, you have a metric theory of gravity. So it seems to me that everything that I've read, except for that one statement, says that this is a metric theory of gravity. So that means that we should be able to look at it in sort of the same way that Will did.
Yeah, but that torsion factor that has that anti-symmetric connection.
Yeah, what you do for this theory is you basically take a contravariant derivative and turn it into a covariant derivative. And what happens then? Well, we all know what happens then, right? Because, you know, we all remember that from differential geometry. That gives the connection an anti-symmetric part. And that anti-symmetric part to the connection basically becomes the torsion. That's the big deal here, is you take the connection, you reverse two of the indices and subtract it from the original connection, divide by two, and then you have your torsion field.
Yeah, and it's just added right on to the normal Einstein tensor.
So that's how it shows up. This way is you have to use this comma goes to semicolon rule, the contravariant goes to a covariant tensor. That's something that even Will talked about in his book. He said that it's a complicated subject and he's not going to talk about it too much in his book, but he mentions it because it was in the 1980s something that people were talking about. In fact, if you look at these papers, there is a reference from the 1980s that they keep referring to, which is a book. I don't see the reference here, but keeps on showing up, all about torsion and gravity. It's by Sabata and Sivaram, Spin and Torsion and Gravitation, World Scientific, 1994. So what do you think about this? Do you think it really does a good job of figuring out dark matter and dark energy?
Well, this particular paper was more of a qualitative, I think, approach to that than a really rigorous one. But I think the next couple of papers do get a bit more into detail, although they are talking in these next two papers about the Einstein-Cartan-Kibble-SIM. Yeah. Is that different? That seems like there's only one torsion field in this one.
Based on my readings, I think that's more normal. There's just one torsion field. And even in the previous paper, in the Accelerating Universe paper, it says that what he's doing, this Poincaré thing that he's doing, that he's calling Poincaré, I'm not sure exactly what it is, he's saying that that's an extension of this extension, adding in that second torsion field that I'm not completely sure what it does.
But in both of the next papers, apparently he does replicate the cosmological constant effect using just this one, the Einstein-Cartan-Kibble-SIMA theory. So I'm not sure if that second one is necessary for those effects.
Well, it might be necessary for both of the effects, because he doesn't talk about dark matter at all in that later paper, I don't think. You know, getting one thing is easier than getting two.
Although it makes me wonder that if you've got just the one force that's a gravitational repulsive force that becomes manifest at cosmological distances, wouldn't that apply like a local pressure onto any galaxy or whatever? You've got some long-range repulsive force acting on it. Maybe it's sufficient to replicate the dark matter effect. He didn't talk about that, though, so I'm not sure if they looked at it.
Well, that would be more general, and I think that if that were the case, people would have found a way to do that with just having dark energy and dark matter. They'd figure out a way to pull those two things together and say, you know, these are both part of the same thing. If all you have is something like a cosmological constant and something like these halos, if there's a way to connect those, somebody would have just found that already, I'd expect. That sounds like exactly the sort of challenge that somebody would give himself over the weekend.
Yeah, I guess the people working at this level of sophistication could probably work that out over coffee one morning.
They could get a pretty good idea. And then they'd have to work with equations for 6 months to make sure it was right.
Yeah.
They could get a pretty good idea pretty quickly. Yeah, this Einstein-Cartan-Sciama-Kibble theory, Sciama and Kibble extended the Einstein-Cartan theory in the 1950s or 60s. And, you know, they gave it a Lagrangian formulation and all of those other things so that it looked more like a modern theory of gravity rather than something that was written in the 1920s. So that's the reason why there are four people there. It is the Einstein-Cartan theory. It's just been improved to look more like the things that we actually look at today.
And this one's really exciting, this non-singular Dirac particles in space-time with torsion paper, because he derives the actual physical dimensions of the electron, because the electron actually shares some fundamental property in common with the black hole solution. So he's able to give like what he thinks the nature of the electron is, and he describes it instead of being a point, which is the current model, that it would actually be a toroid.
Yeah, so there are three reasons why, you know, you end up with this Einstein-Cartan theory. Sometimes it just comes out of using this kind of derivative in your definitions, right? The covariant derivative in your definitions of the connection. It was originally proposed to solve singularity problems, to get away from black holes and stuff like that. The reason why most people are interested in it is because it's a way to incorporate spin into general relativity. And if you can do that, then you can make one of your theories of everything. So even if it doesn't work exactly correctly, it should give you some idea about what should be happening in that regime. And in here, it figures out these dimensions for the toroid. I'm not really sure what he gets out of that. So, I mean, basically what he does is he says that if you have this solution, if you can create this torsion field from the spins and stuff like that, then you can't have a true point particle. So that was the first thing he was saying in there. You can't have the singularity, right? Like I just said, that's the whole reason Cartan originally invented it. Get rid of those singularities.
Yeah, and he even got rid of the Kerr-Newman singular ring concept also.
And that was the second part, is he says you get rid of the singular ring from the Kerr-Newman solution. Then he says, so you have to have at least a two-dimensional thing. You know, you don't have just a zero-dimensional point. You don't have a one-dimensional string. So you have to have two-dimensional tube at minimum. I guess it's a toroid, it's really three dimensions. But still, you know, you have two different parameters to tell you what's going on at any given point of this thing. Whether that's really a torus or if it's something a little weirder, I don't know. He says inner radius and outer radius. To me, that indicates that it's not the radius of the ring and then the radius of the tube. So I'm not, that's the way I'd sort of envision it if you just said it's a toroid and here are these two parameters, especially if you have these two parameters that are so different. So he's saying that the outer radius is about the Compton wavelength, which is huge. It's 10 to the minus 12 meters. It's larger than the nucleus of an atom. Then he says the second radius, the inner radius, is 10 to the minus 27 meters. It's even smaller than our maximum value for the size of an electron that we measure with a pinning trap.
Mm-hmm. Which was like 10 to the minus 22, I think.
So it's like five orders of magnitude smaller than that. So if you just envision it as a torus, this is an extremely skinny tube. It would be hard to tell the difference between it and a string.
When he said inner and outer, he meant like major axis and minor axis, right?
I have no idea what he meant. He doesn't say anything about what he meant. That might not mean anything what he meant because it's not really a three-dimensional entity. It just has to have the same topological properties as a torus. So that does not necessarily mean it is a torus.
Okay, but what he found by having the Cartan radius of the electron being 10 to the minus 27th meters, that introduces an effective ultraviolet cutoff.
Yeah, I guess this gets back to what you were saying about the ultraviolet stuff.
Yeah, that's an incredibly skinny tubular shape, because, I mean, I'm thinking the neutron has a mean square radius of like 10 to the minus 15th meters. So you're talking many orders of magnitude smaller than that.
There would have to be, right? So if this is how you're going to build an electron, then you're going to have to do something similar when you're building your quarks.
Yeah, I guess so. They'd all have to be some kind of toroid shape, right? Hey, he calculated a maximum density for matter, too, which was interesting, of 10 to the 51 kilograms per cubic meter.
What's the maximum density that's been observed?
The maximum density that's been observed? Boy, I don't know. I mean, neutronium is like 4 times 10 to the 17th kilograms per cubic meter. So you're talking, you know, like 34 orders of magnitude denser than that.
So you got plenty of room to work with it.
Yeah, I think the densest matter we've ever seen is like quark gluon plasma, and it's just maybe a little bit more dense than neutronium. I think maybe a couple or orders of magnitude denser. But yeah, we're talking way more dense. So that only becomes significant in regimes like the Big Bang and black holes.
Was this a paper where it was busy not liking the Big Bang, or was that the next one?
I think it was the next one.
Yeah, they don't like the Big Bang in Europe because they think it's too American.
Because it's got such a dumb name. I mean, Big Bang is such a dumb name. The final paper does enjoy the concept of the big bounce a lot more, and it does make sense mechanically, but I always feel like that's putting off the problem. The big bounce doesn't really answer the question of how did the universe originate. So are we left with the idea that the universe is maybe some kind of like closed loop through four-dimensional space-time where it just has always existed and it bounces back and forth forever? I don't know. I mean, where does the universe come from if there wasn't a Big Bang?
That is very parochial three-dimensional thinking. If you're looking for an origin to the universe, then, you know, the big bounce doesn't help you. I think the issue is always going to be something that has more to do with what we see, this inflationary stuff. What has to happen for our physics models and our observational models to match up. I think the problem there is it just tells you some stuff that doesn't make a lot of sense, at least as far as the physics is concerned, right?
Yeah, there's the whole problem of why wouldn't it collapse back into a singularity immediately because the density would be so high. That's kind of a stickler. And what made the thing blow up in the first place? There's no known law of physics to do that.
There are a lot of things that don't really make a lot of sense about it. When you talk about something like a big bounce or something like that, where you have this eternal, it's not really a loop because after the bounce, you don't have to go back to the same state because it's a big chaotic mess.
Although, isn't the idea that with what we've seen so far in the cosmic microwave background radiation and all that kind of stuff saying that the universe started in a state of extreme order and it was only subsequently that the whole entropy increased at this huge rate? I'm not really sure how it works with big bounce.
Yeah, the entropy is much lower at the beginning than now. But with the big bounce, you're not going back to a zero entropy state. So that would mean that you end up coming back based on your return positions, which will not necessarily be the same as the old return positions.
So it's just like a rewrite, you know, start with the same basic rules and have a completely different reality for a while until it bounces back.
That's how I always envisioned it. I always envisioned it as the world is created, it does all its stuff, comes back sort of together. If it gets to a point where it has to repel again. And when it comes back out, you know, it's some completely different thing. And because of the unfortunate sizes of the continua and countable numbers, you'll get things that are close to what happened before happening again at some indeterminate point in the future, but never exactly the same.
Or it's possible also that somehow all of the, that it reaches some kind of incredibly ordered state, you know, at a really high density, and then Nietzsche would be right and you'd have the eternal recurrence going on.
If it somehow came back to its original state, then you'd end up with an eternal recurrence of some kind. But that's one of these things that ends up being highly unlikely as long as you have all this chaos going on. Basically, if you have deterministic chaos, which it looks like we do, then you're probably not going to have something like that. You know, this is really highly speculative.
Yeah, we're getting into philosophy. That's always a bad move.
I don't want to say this isn't real stuff because, you know, they have real mathematical arguments here. But, you know, the way I talk about it, the way I envision it, you know, it's sort of the way you'd envision it if you're sitting around on a Saturday night with a bunch of friends with the substance of your choice.
Well, I can bring it back down to physics. I did find the factor that I was looking for. The Kerr-Newman solution has the same gyromagnetic ratio as that of the Dirac electron. Yeah, it was the gyromagnetic ratio for a spinning black hole that is the same as the Dirac electron, which is just a crazy coincidence or a sign of a very deep underlying physical reality, of, you know, which is what they're arguing for here.
Yeah, I think it's quite interesting. I mean, if we take this all the way back to when we talked about gravito-electromagnetism, one of the interesting things is that for gravitation and for electricity, there are no vector sources. They're all point sources. Obviously, this is saying there's no such thing as a true point source. But, you know, if you just have density, if you just have a density-like thing, then that would be close enough to a point source. You know, it just gives you a scalar field, a scalar density field rather than a vector density field. If you put the spin in, now you have a vector source for gravitation as well, which is a little more like magnetism.
But that's where the gyromagnetic ratio comes in for the Dirac electron, right?
Yeah, that makes this all very interesting. You know, you've got something that has to do with your conservation of angular momentum, you know, in creating this torsion field. That's the reason why you want to have it there. That's the reason why it's anti-symmetric as well.
Why do they call it the spin density instead of the angular momentum? Spin density, I wasn't really sure what that means.
I mean, he's got a thing in here that he calls spin density, and he also has a thing that's the torsion field, and they're kind of related, but I don't really completely understand how.
Well, I was just wondering why he was using spin density instead of angular momentum. Maybe momentum doesn't come into it. That's right, because the mass doesn't have anything to do with it. The mass and the charge don't come into it.
So we have something that has to do with that intrinsic angular momentum of a fermion, maybe of a boson too, but, you know, of a quantum mechanical particle. They have an intrinsic angular momentum, and they're saying this shows up somehow in gravitational theory, in this case, by creating a second tensor field in the gravity. And so the thing that we know about that could do that is the spin. And again, the reason why most people pursue this particular theory, the Einstein-Cartan theory, is to try to get spin into general relativity.
It looks like the right direction to go for a unified field theory. Like, if you're looking for a grand unified theory, this does seem like it, right? That's the right way to go. It does seem like there aren't many people working on it, though, and I guess I'm not sure why. Maybe it's very challenging mathematically subject. I mean, general relativity itself is complicated. You start adding in these spin fields and torsion fields and everything, and it's pretty hairy. It's almost as hairy as Isaac Barr's two-time physics.
Oh, I don't think this is anything like that.
Yeah, but aren't you trying to model space-time as this perfect fluid, and it's spinning and creating this additional torsion field, which is really difficult to envision. I mean, I have a hard enough time in envisioning that. It's kind of difficult to even imagine, like, the higher order effects of general relativity, like gravitational waves, which have that bizarre spin to graviton. So you add that stuff all into, like, a spinning field that's changing, very difficult to visualize property inside the matter itself. My imagination has a hard time wrangling with that as a visual thing, you know?
That will be a little more difficult to figure out. But, I mean, as far as the mathematics is concerned, it doesn't have the sort of challenge that mathematics does. This stuff is still all just tensor analysis. The Troutman paper that you sent me by mistake, that paper about the Einstein-Cartan theory did use a lot of topology and the really advanced mathematics that these guys can use. But these ones don't really get into that. They're mostly just dealing with elementary differential geometry.
That's true. That, I think that other paper did showcase that when you really get into the mechanics of it, that's what you have to deal with, right? So these were more like overview papers, kind of. This paper that we're going over right now did a really good job of just, like, showing the basic way that they were able to arrive at a finite density and a topology for fermions and black hole singularities and things, but they didn't get too much into the intricacies of the, you know, underlying mathematics of this theory.
Okay, so let's see. We've done the thing about the particle sizes, right? We've done big bounce. We've done the toroidal shape. So the only thing that's left that I see is that Pavlovsky has decided that this can resolve the problem with the asymmetry of matter and antimatter, that matter-antimatter asymmetry.
And that's because of the coupling of the spin field to the curvature of space-time, right?
Something like that. I mean, it was pretty brief the way he explained that. I was hoping you could explain it to me.
Oh, no. He just kind of touched on it, and all I could think of is that I was wondering if this would be supported, this notion would be supported by the kaon decay experiments. Like, I remember reading that they thought that maybe it was the interaction with curved space-time that caused the kaon to decay asymmetrically and create an abundance, I think, of matter than antimatter.
So basically, the issue is that in this case, we have this antisymmetric part of the connection. The charge conjugate spinner field gives you a different decay rate in the Dirac equation. So now you have a different decay rate. The decay rate is faster for the antimatter, so you lose that antimatter. But I'd expect that that's something that you could actually measure, right? Not completely certain, but that sounds to me like something that you could measure from collider experiments.
Oh, I thought that he was talking about that in context of, like, the very early universe where the density was so high that the torsion field would have a more noticeable effect on things like the decay rate and everything. Do you think that that's true, that he was talking about that in terms of just ordinary conditions like a lab? Because I was thinking that it would make sense, because the baryogenesis issue, that was a really early universe thing where matter dominated over antimatter, so I assumed that it was the physics of the early universe that would allow that to happen.
No, I was wrong. It says only at the early universe, see reference 26. So reference 26 explains that in Physical Review D. Okay, so you're absolutely right. That's only in the early universe. I don't know why, because he doesn't say.
I guess it's just, I think that he mentions in here at some point something about how this specific variety of the, I guess any Einstein-Cartan theory really doesn't make any different predictions from GR until you're in these super high-density regimes like black holes in the early universe, you know? So it does make you wonder, though, what does that say about conditions in a black hole? You know, what's going on inside there? How does that influence pair production, for example? Like, really close to that, I guess I can't call it a singularity anymore, really close to the internal toroid? Maybe pair production is skewed there, too.
Weren't they talking about what happens on the inside of the black hole in one of these papers?
Well, the last paper gets into some really exotic stuff. So I think he might have gotten into it there.
Where he was saying something about if you have a black hole, you get a new universe inside it every time.
Yeah. And he was saying that our universe could have been born by a black hole that had been created from something like three solar masses or something, like some moderate-sized black hole, which is a wild idea. I kind of love that idea. I mean, it's this totally science fiction-sounding thing. He was making a lot of really bold statements in this final paper. Oh, let's see. This was the space-time torsion is a possible remedy to major problems in gravity and cosmology. I mean, he just let it all hang out in this one.
You know, these descriptions really give you some interesting ideas. I'm just not sure the right way to interpret them and how to evaluate them.
Yeah, that's the thing, is he threw a lot of really fascinating concepts out in this paper, but he didn't delve too deeply into, like, proving or really arguing for the validity of each one. He just kind of threw them all out, and I was like, wow, this guy's, like, just cutting loose.
I mean, a lot of it's because he's referring back to his and other people's work in previous papers, so I'm not sure what to make of it. I mean, sometimes he went from one subject to another so fast, I wasn't really able to figure out how things were connected.
Yeah, I felt kind of the same way, too. He does touch on a lot of fascinating ideas, though. He argues that this theory solves the flatness problem, the fact that the current universe is, you know, geometrically apparently indiscernible from flat, without cosmic inflation. I think he models how the Big Bounce, which he notes is also predicted by loop quantum gravity, would allow this universe to go from a causally connected body of matter into something like 10 to the power of 32 sort of shell-like universes that would be causally connected within themselves, but not each other, which is another really fascinating idea that I'd never heard before. And then he gets into how every black hole produces a new closed, non-singular universe inside.
I mean, that energy has to be doing something in there. All right, have we hit everything you wanted, or was there something else?
Let's see, he said the universe may have originated from the interior of an intermediate mass black hole, and then he says, that was the other thing that I really loved about this, is he says that the time-symmetric collapse of matter through the event horizon therefore defines the arrow of time of such a universe.
So all the energy that it's pulling out of one universe into the other is giving you that arrow of time.
Yeah, because it's coming through the throat, right?
Makes sense.
Yeah, it does make sense.
I mean, it's absolutely impossible to figure out whether it's true or not, but...
Yeah, I wish we could send an instrument in and find out, but that's kind of impossible by nature.
Okay, so we got it all figured out? Are we now experts in the Einstein-Cartan theory of gravity?
Oh, God, no. But it is a lot of fun, and it was a fun introductory episode into the idea. And maybe we can do some more follow-up in the future about it and see what they're doing with it now. It has been a few years since any of these papers were published, and I'd love to see what kind of theoretical work they're doing these days.
Maybe we can focus more on just one subject about what they're trying to do with it and just figure that out, because there are a lot of statements in these papers about what this does for you, but you know, they don't really tell you why a lot of the time.
Yeah, a couple of these were more like letters, and they weren't really as deep as some of the review papers and so forth that we've gone into.
Yeah, but you put a page limit on us. We can't do review papers anymore.
Well, when you're stuck reading like 30 or 40 pages of really hard material, it's like, okay, we're going to spend the entire freaking day reading, studying, checking out sources and everything. I mean, it's like a 12-hour investment.
That's why you have to hire an assistant, right?
Well, I'll be accepting volunteer applications at our podcast website, Physics Frontiers, Podomatic.
Okay, so any Physics Frontiers-y thing, you can volunteer to be one of Randy's assistants. He needs a lot. All right. Thank you very much, Randy.
Thank you, Jim. It's always good to talk with you about this thing.
All right, and we'll figure out what to talk about in the next episode pretty soon. All right?
That's right. There's a wild world of possibilities in physics.
Just have to narrow it down.
We'll do it.
All right. Bye now, Randy.
Good night, Jim.
You have just listened to Physics Frontiers 37, the Einstein-Cartan torsion field theory. Show notes can be found at frontiers.physicsfm.com/37. The notes include links to the papers we've discussed in this program, as well as links to previous shows on similar topics, and basically anything else I decide that I want to put in there. Now you're still listening. I thank you for enjoying this podcast. I would like to ask you, if you can, to help us out a little by going to Patreon, www.patreon.com/physicsfrontiers, and helping us out a little. It would be very helpful. Thank you very much.